Well, good morning and welcome to the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN Radio out of Northfield, Minnesota. 1080 on your AM dial. It will be our 51st Christmas in just less than 2 weeks. And now, of course, 95.1 FM, The One. I'd like to introduce you to my guest this morning, and that would be Dr. Leo Lewis III. Leo, thank you very much for coming down to Northfield, Minnesota today.
Well, Wayne, it's always great to come and talk with you and be on the air, and of course, it's good to come to Northfield.
Yeah, now we're going to, as we talk this morning, we're going to find out that you have a connection to Northfield other than the fact that you've been on my show.
Yeah.
And the fact that you've golfed at our golf club on more than one occasion.
Yeah.
But I was just trying to remember, you know, time really flies. We were talking in the green room about aches and pains and things that happen.
Yeah.
And you graduated in 1975 from high school. Was that in Missouri?
Man, that was a long time ago.
Well,
yeah. Columbia Hickman High School in Columbia, Missouri.
Okay, and Columbia, Missouri is the home of the University of Missouri.
Yeah, University of Columbia campus.
And they are known for educating broadcasters and newsmen and sports announcers, etc.
Yep, they have a great journalism school. We've got quite a few graduates in the Twin Cities who are working for some of our well-known establishments up there.
And, of course, I was telling you about my exchange student from Denmark.
Oh, right.
Well, he went to Columbia.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Well, good for him. Now he's put a little bit more higher on the scale here.
Yeah. He was here in 91, and I'm thinking you were with the Vikings in the 80s?
81 to 91.
81. 10 years.
Yeah, but it seems so long ago.
Yeah, it doesn't to me. It doesn't to me. And, you know, a lot of people, when I have a Viking on, your friend Stu Voigt is a regular on my show.
Right.
He once, you know, did play-by-play for WCCO and the Vikings. He did color, excuse me.
That's right.
And then your friend Paul Kraus, you know, he just had successful surgery.
Yeah, I heard about that. I'm glad he came out of it really well.
And, of course, Boom Boom passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been past your time, though. But anyhow.
Yeah, you know, Kraus and Voigt and Bill Brown, they all you know, played primarily in the 60s and 70s and,
right.
You know, during the Purple People Eater era. And, you know, we made that transition when Tarkington left, and we ended up drafting Tommy Kramer. And that was the new wave of guys that came in the late 70s and early 80s. So I was a part of that group. You know, certainly after all of the Purple People Eaters retired or left and went somewhere else. But I think it's again, another era in Viking lore where, you know, you can point to, you know, certain people that you played with. And when you do that, people then all say, oh, okay, I remember that time.
And the youngest one of that group would have been Suds, Doug Sutherland.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what does this remind you of?
Your satchel?
It's called a merce.
Okay.
But it's a man's purse.
Oh, okay.
And they do call it a merce.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, not like a woman's handbag. It's it's nice and convenient to carry your stuff in.
Uh-huh.
Does that remind you of anybody that wore a purse ever? Maybe you're too young.
Well, I tell you what. I mean, you know, athletic people wear, you know, things like that for their athletic wear. And, you know, they come in all sizes and shapes. And so it looks familiar, but I've never seen one that was leather, though.
Yeah, well, guess who used to wear those? Carl Eller and Jim Marshall.
Oh, okay.
And I remember the first time I saw them put that over their neck and carry it like a woman carries a purse.
Right.
I thought, man, these are, you know, dudes.
And they're
but it is very convenient. I just, that was way before your time.
Well, but, you know, in the early 80s, you know, you did have these man bags as well where you could, you know, you put your keys and your wallet and everything. I think those were, you know, certainly popular as well, you know, at least in the athletic community because, you know, you always was carting around something.
Well, when you just said that, you reminded me of something. I used to be so proud when I would come in the locker room after a game, and I would chit-chat with you, and I had given you, and I don't know if you'll remember, I gave you a little bag that had KYMN radio on it. It was gray. Okay. You unzippered it,
yep.
And then you could pull out what you carry your suit in.
Of course.
What is that called? Anyhow, you know, the kind you hang up.
Of course.
And you use that, and then it had another bag inside where mm-hmm. you had your toiletries and
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I'd come in and you'd use it hanging in the locker room,
I'd say,
WCCO doesn't have anybody.
No,
with
they
any.
Don't.
I thought that was so cool. And, of course, you were built like a brick, well, whatever you say.
And that was back in the day, though.
Yeah, but you look good. You look good.
Well, thank you.
You look good. Got any aches and pains at all after 10
years? Well, of course.
No, not 10 years. You were in NFL for what, about 14 years?
No, 11 years, but 13 years overall. And, you know, my history started with the old St. Louis Cardinals my rookie year before they moved to Arizona. And that was legendary. And then the next year I went to Canada and played for the Calgary Stampeders. And so I had 2 years in before I even came to the Vikings. And then, you know, came in as a free agent. And, you know, Bud always liked to have kids of his friends or former teammates come in, and I don't think I was ever given a chance because they gave me the number 46.
So, 46?
Yeah, as a wide receiver, so no, I don't think I was projected to make the team. And you know, nonetheless, and after being cut, you know, that year, they brought me back, and I stayed ever since. But it was tough to make it then, and it's just like it is now. It's very very difficult game to play, and tough to make it and last a long time in the league.
And by the way, folks, there's a whole lot more to Leo Lewis than football, but a lot of listeners are my age or younger,
yeah,
or older, and they remember you and they mm-hmm. want to hear about it. And then those that don't remember you, unfortunately. Does that hurt the ego at all? I mean, you went to school, mm-hmm. you got a doctorate degree,
yep,
did many things in your lifetime so far.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to try to figure out how old you are, okay?
Well, I tell you what, it started early, and you know, I'm not here to really reveal my age, but you can kind of calculate since I went to college and started college.
Well, the way I look at it, 75 means you were born in 57.
Something like that. That's
yeah,
right.
Okay, which means you just turned 60 last year.
Well, I'm 62. I was born in 56. But,
okay.
And it has been a long haul, tell you the truth. I think that I would have never thought that I'd be able to play in the NFL, nonetheless, be able to, you know, still make my home here in Minnesota. Although, you know, my dad grew up in St. Paul and went to college in Missouri. That's where he met my mother, and that's kind of where I grew up. But it has been a wonderful ride. I think one of the things that I've always pointed to is the fact that maybe there was a blessing that I wasn't drafted and didn't have all of the easy ways of making the team, but had to struggle every day, every year to make the team. And at the same time, always was looking for an alternative career. So, you know, I continued my education throughout my playing career. And I think it's really benefited me because it gave me a balanced life and a balanced perspective on, you know, life after football.
What is your doctorate degree in?
I have a PhD in kinesiology. And
that's easy.
It's a very I know.
Kinesiology.
You know, it used to be kinesiology. Used to be a course where you study the aspects of human movement, and it's more biomechanics now. But now it's a broad term, and I graduated from the University of Minnesota in 1997 with my PhD. But I'm centered more toward the behavioral sciences. You know, sports psychology is a kind of popular term right now. So, you know, I'm a certified sports psychology performance enhancement coach. And then I think I teach a course at the U now that looks at the diversity and social and cultural aspects of sport. So we get more involved in why we have this social practice, such a sport in our culture, and not so much on who wins, what the score is, what the stats are. And it's pretty interesting because that's kind of how consumers are driven toward, you know, who wins and, you know, what the scores are, you know, and it's more about who are these people who are engaged in this sport. And it's not just about the players or coaches. It's about all those other people who work in this industry and who help make it possible. And, you know, certainly the owners are another part of this as well. So you ask the questions, how did this come to be? Of course. And, you know, I focus a little bit more on the NFL, but you've got other leagues and other sports that, you know, encompass, you know, what makes us great as a country and is a reflection on what we do as well.
Now, in your studies, did you go all the way back to Greece?
Well, you know, the history of sport does give a reveal a lot about us. You know, certainly the you know, sport in Europe lays the foundation for what we call the Olympics, which is a more worldly approach to sport and how we look at sport from an international perspective. But, you know, I think sport in this country mirrors our history. I mean, most of the sport participation occurred in with the working class becoming entertainment for the elites or the privileged class. And soon it became a more consumer-driven activity where people would actually go and see this entertainment. So most of the people involved in a lot of these sports today don't participate. You know, they are consumers and spectators. Mm-hmm. So that's how it originated.
Well, that would go back to the Roman Colosseum, wouldn't it?
Of course. And, you know, I think you're looking at more of a international perspective. And in order to understand what goes on here in our country, we don't necessarily need to have to go back that far. But you're right. I think some of the way that sport was used as a cultural practice in Europe, you know, in the Roman era, Greece, was really seen through it being part of a religious practice and part of a ritual that was part of the culture there. So, and it has been in our country where the Puritans come and disdain that whole notion of activity outside of work, but then certainly the whole aspect of it being a secular approach as well. So that's how I got started here in our country as well, where, you know, the working class, or in some respect you can say those indentured servants, became the entertainers for the elite class. And it started really to progress in the late 1800s. And then we would see it now then in the early 1900s. Be more endemic in the at the college level, where students started these activities on college campuses, or in the Industrial Revolution, where immigrants would come and bring their social practices to our country. And because of the Industrial Revolution, you had a lot of downtime, and people congregated in cities, big cities. You had a lot of downtime, and, you know, some of these social practices would occur. So there's a lot of history that we get into as well in my class, and it's a broad amount of information. And because I teach undergraduates, we can't get involved too much in one topic or one part of it. So it's more of a broad brush into how sport and physical activity is seen in our country. And you know, present day, you know, now we're seeing another evolution where we talk about e-sports, electronic sports and video games, and how our youth are now spending a lot of their waking hours looking at a screen and participating in sports, what they consider sports.
And I have to say, and I said it before, when it comes to the games that these kids are playing, I'm not into that stuff, but I did have a Dr. Mario. I don't know if you remember that game, Dr. Mario. This is, you know, 20 years.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
But I actually would see the game in my head at night when I was trying to go to sleep. And I actually could see, and you know, how they were falling in place and all that. And I'm thinking, well, if that's happening to me, what are these kids that are killing in the prostitution and all of the pornography and stuff that they can get to on their phones?
Of course.
I wonder if that has a mental impact on some of the youth of America mm-hmm. today, but I get a little bit too deep there.
Well, I mean, we don't know what the influence is. Yeah. I'm sure for some youth that is a major influence in their minds and how they look at the world, and that's why it's always good to have schools where we can send our kids so that they can focus more on what we believe is a more important endeavor, and that is to be educated in various ways and not necessarily be intimidated or influenced by some of the discerning issues in our country and some of it that's filtered through these electronic objects that we hold dear to us all the time.
And you just can't leave the house without the phone. How many times have you, and I'm talking to you, listening to the radio, how many times have you gone back to the house because you forgot your phone?
Right.
18 minutes after 9 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair, Leo Lewis is my guest. Dr. Lewis is a former Minnesota Viking and now a professor at the U of M. And I am going to talk about a place in town called the Quarterback Club. I'd buy you lunch. I don't know if you're going to take me up on that or not.
Man, I'm going to take you up on anything you have today.
Okay, well, we'll go over to the QB, and you can get anything from a flame-broiled burger to baby-back barbecued ribs with mountains of madness oozing all over them and their special sauce. It's delicious.
I'm surprised they don't have a Wayne Eddy burger or sandwich over there by now, as many times as you've been over there.
You know, I never even thought of that.
I may have to advocate
You'll have to
for that.
Talk to Dale Finger about that and see if he can do that. But anyhow, the Quarterback Club is open for breakfast right now every morning, Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. to 10 a.m., and on Saturday, 7 in the morning until 10 in the morning. And don't forget their famous roasted chicken. If you're busy Christmas shopping and wrapping and all that, bring home a bucket of their delicious roasted chicken. That's at the QB, the Quarterback Club in Northfield, for over 50 years. Leo, you are probably right about the age when Sports Illustrated came out with something when you were probably in high school, maybe college, I don't know, but you're in the world of, can say that
kinesiology.
Word? Kinesiology.
Yeah.
They had a big edition in Sports Illustrated comparing a black athlete with a Caucasian athlete, and they had diagrams or whatever you call it of the foot and the thigh and the calf and the arms and the muscles, and trying to show the reason the black population athletes are superior to the Caucasian is because. Did you study that, or did you read that, or do you remember that?
Well, I think it is part of our history in terms of how we define ethnic groups, and you know, I think it's not a complete science, because really, who is black and who is white? I mean, you really have to figure out through DNA measurements as to how this politically defined name, black and white and whatever, is measured. So let's just say, for one thing, that, you know, these names are politically defined. I mean, there's no evidence that really can concretely determine who is what they are or how we determine them to be. So, but I think
I'd have to disagree with you.
Well, I think I think it's through science. Yeah, go ahead.
The NFL.
Yeah.
The NBA.
Mm-hmm.
And it's obvious that the black athlete is superior to the Caucasian. Obvious.
Well, I tell you what, though, Wayne, there's hundreds of sports, okay, and we have been, as consumers, fed continuously the just only a few sports in our culture. You know, football, basketball, track and field, wrestling. You will find that African Americans, for example, are prominent in only three or four of those sports of all the hundreds of sports in this country that are participated in. So I can name tens of hundreds of sports where African Americans are not predominant. And speaking from a historical standpoint, it's really because African Americans have spent a lot of time and value-oriented time in these sports. Basketball, for example, The culture in the African American community really values basketball. It really values football. It doesn't so much value swimming, lacrosse, to soccer in that extent.
And even baseball nowadays.
Baseball, yeah. Mm-hmm. You see very few African Americans at the professional level. There are patches in our country where, in some areas in our country where, you know, African Americans do participate in other sports, but it's really just a small segment of all the types of sports that are out there that are predominantly participated in by African Americans. And when we talk about that, we mean that the ratio is above what the percentage of African Americans who are in this country. So I can name a number of sports. Let's just say, for example, the 25 sports that the University of Minnesota sponsors.
25?
You've got volleyball. You've got certainly basketball, ice hockey, for example. You've got gymnastics, tennis, golf. And if you were to look on TV or to understand the sport, you'd see very few African Americans who are participating in those sports. So what the consumer sees, obviously, are the big money revenue generating sports on our TV because they are valued more by the corporate community. And the interests of the corporate community are to support these long-held beliefs that football and basketball are important to our culture. And that's why you see them on TV the most. But again, the consumer can see then by looking at these sports that, yes, they're valued more because they're on TV the most. It must mean then, for example, that African Americans, for example, are good at it. When if we were to look at hockey all day, ice hockey all day, we wouldn't necessarily have that opinion.
I think there's one or two in the NHL.
Well, there's quite a few.
Are there? Okay.
I think maybe a ratio of one to each team. So
well,
not a significant amount of them are in the NHL, for example, because it's not valued in those communities, and so that's why we have to. Take a step back to kind of understand the history and the cultural effect of some of these sports. For example, a good example that's emerging these days is that women professional golfers. Of the top 10 women professional golfers, about 7 of them are from Asian countries. And is that to say that they're better golfers? I wouldn't necessarily say that because we have a lot of good golfers in the United States. But I would say that those communities value golf as a recreational as well as a professional pursuit much more than they have in the past. And it just so happens that these Asian golfers are good at it. And, you know, the top-ranked golfer is from Thailand. So we wouldn't necessarily think of that in the women's game. But we can also see a number of individuals in the men's game that are representing certain ethnic groups as well. You know, Tiger Woods comes out to be kind of the forerunner in all of this. Again, there are a number of golfers from different countries around the world that participate in golf. And it's a pretty held belief that it's an elite sport because it just costs so much to play. It's hard to get coaches and the industry to go down to the grassroots level and be influential in our kids' decisions to play sports. And at the same time, it's competing with track and field and in some respects basketball and football on the fall and spring end, which, you know, are sports that are really held in high esteem from a lot of our youth. So, I mean, so that's one perspective that you can have, and certainly, so it does beg the argument that I wouldn't necessarily say African American athletes are better athletes. It's just that we see them in a concentration of the most valued sports in our culture.
No, I never thought of it that way. So, now, are you a NASCAR fan at all?
Not really.
Okay, well,
but I appreciate the fact that that it's a strongly important sport in our culture, but that's also a culturally defined sport as well. You know, we kind of call it a pro sport, a proletariat sport, you know, held by working blue collar held beliefs, and because it has artifacts that resemble some of the working class culture, you know, cars, mm-hmm. you know, certainly blue collar industry people can affiliate with it quite naturally, and that's based on the research that's being done.
The professional NASCAR drivers, they still make a big deal out of having an African American in a competitive car.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm thinking, wow, in this day and age, they're pointing that out.
Yeah.
Well, it's a fact. There aren't many high-level NASCAR.
Well, there's not many women either. And I think it's always good to point out some of the diversity in your sport, because it does, it may give another woman or another African American interest, an opportunity to do exactly that. But if you don't see anyone that looks like you, it's pretty hard to get you motivated to do it. And that just seems to be part of the natural aspect of why people get engaged with certain sports. You know, I maybe you can look back to when you were a kid, you find that most of your influencers or support mechanisms came from your parents initially. Sometimes you would engage in sport because your parents engaged in them, and then the next social support would be your peers. And you know, that's kind of how I got involved, because my peers were engaged in these sports, and I look back on my daughters and how they got involved with sport, and it was because their friends participated in soccer and lacrosse. And I think we have to understand that our culture, if it doesn't give us opportunities to engage in other types of sports, then we're going to be more focused on the ones that are available and the ones that have more access for us.
Now, I have to take a break, but my next question would be, is this the conversation that we're having right now, is this basically what you do in front of the students that take your courses?
Oh, of course, yeah, okay. And we examine all facets. There's many facets to the sport in our culture, and it reflects just everything that we do in our culture and in our country.
Okay, we will take this break. We'll be back with Leo Lewis right after this important timeout.
Wanamingo Mutual Insurance wishes you and your family a most joyous holiday season. It's time for families to gather together and enjoy the love that comes with the Yuletide. It's been a pleasure to do business with you this past year. Best wishes from the Wanamingo Mutual Insurance Agency. Visit with Bonnie for more information about her good insurance rates. She can save you money and is happy to give you an estimate. For all your insurance needs, contact the Wanamingo Mutual Insurance Agency in Wanamingo.
Polypack Plastics in Medford would like to take this time to wish you and yours a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Polypack Plastics is your source for plastic bags from as small as 1 inch to up to 6 feet long. Polypack Plastics, where your order is in the bag.
Welcome back to the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN, a friend you definitely can count on. Our guest this morning is Dr. Leo Lewis III, and you said something that is music to my heart. But I want to, what was my question before we took the break?
Well, we were talking about sports.
Yeah. And, okay. But I got something on my mind. Now, is your dad still living?
No, he isn't. My father passed away 5 years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And but I would say this year, earlier this year, he was inducted into the Black College Football Hall of Fame, which is a aspiring organization that's held by Doug, started by Doug Williams. That's now vice president of the Washington Redskins. And, you know, he was already in the College Football Hall of Fame. But interesting enough, the Black College Football Hall of Fame is there to recognize student athletes who participated in these historically black colleges before,
like
they were
Grambling?
Allowed. Yeah, like Grambling and Southern and Howard University. But, you know, it's to recognize a lot of these student athletes, like my father, who couldn't go to, you know, these majority white colleges at the time in the early 40s and 50s, but excelled in sport in these historically black colleges. And, you know, my father was a 3-time All-American and you know, at one time held the record, NCAA record for the number of yards rushing in a career. And he went to Lincoln University, which is in Jefferson City, Missouri. And interesting enough, it was the closest black college from where he lived in St. Paul. And, you know, we still have some of this pipeline where a number of African-American students, high school students, still go to some of these colleges because they want to get a different experience, obviously. But I think that's the most I think he would believe that, that would be the most proud moment that he would have had if by being inducted into this college Hall of Fame as well.
Did he show you where he lived in St. Paul?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, I'm number one Northfield.
Okay.
50-some years I've been here.
Yeah.
But number two in St. Paul, I went to three different high schools in St. Mm-hmm. Paul. I lived all over the city.
I bet.
So I want to ask if he showed you where he lived.
Yeah.
And if you can tell me the streets and stuff, I'll tell you how close I lived to him.
Oh, of course. Well, you know, my dad was one of 11 kids, so they all lived in 700 block of Carroll Avenue.
I know exactly where it
is. In the Rondo neighborhood.
Yes.
And he went to Old Marshall High School, which
is no longer there.
Yeah.
And, I went to Central.
Yeah. And some of his younger brothers and sisters went to Mechanic Arts. And my cousins went to Central and Highland Park. And, you know, so.
Highland Park, those are young cousins.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that, you know.
Highland Park didn't have a high school when I was in high school.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah. I know. And, you know, some of them. You know, are you know, certainly younger than I am, but we would always come up here. My father, you know, if many of you listeners don't know, my father was also a football player and professional football player, but he played in Canada most of his years and played for the Winnipeg Blue Bombers.
So that's where the Bud Grant connection comes?
Yeah, it does, because he and Bud Grant were teammates in Winnipeg. You know, Bud was also drafted, as well as my dad, in the NFL, but they made much more money in the CFL than they did in the NFL. And this is right before, you know, professional football was, you know, had agreements with the television stations and were able to get a lot of TV revenue. So they weren't really on TV that much, so they couldn't necessarily compete with salaries. So my dad actually made more money in the CFL than he would have if he was in the NFL.
What position?
He was a running back, but at the same time, he was drafted by the Baltimore Colts, so he missed being able to play with Johnny Unitas and Alan Ameche on their championship teams. But at the same time, he and Bud played in Winnipeg, and, you know, my dad is in the Hall of Fame in the Canadian Football League as well. And, you know, Bud coached the team to six championships, and they won four Grey Cups.
He was a player coach, wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, no, he wasn't a player coach, but he played with the Bombers before he coached there.
Okay.
I mean, he coached really early in life. He was in his early 30s when he was the head coach there and, you know, coached my dad. And then consequently, I would be able to play with Bud and be coached by him as well. So Dad played most of his, all of his career in Winnipeg.
Are you familiar with St. Paul?
Very yourself? Much so, yeah.
Okay, well, you mentioned your dad went to Mechanic Arts.
No, he went to Marshall High School, and his younger siblings went to Mechanic Arts.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, I lived on, see if you can visualize these.
Okay.
Selby and Western.
Okay, yeah. There's a restaurant, there's a coffee shop.
W.A. Frost,
and
is that? Okay. How about Selby and Western? How about... Dale and Grand.
Dale and Grand. Dale, yeah, okay.
Okay.
Of course.
This one you probably won't get. Hamlin and Marshall.
Now, I'm not sure where Hamlin is, but I know where Marshall is.
That's the Lake Street Bridge.
Okay. That's further west.
Marshall is, it's the western, from downtown out to Minneapolis.
Of course.
And then I lived a lot of places on the east side.
Okay.
Of I don't think you'd be familiar with the east side.
Well, I've been there, but in terms of street names, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
You know, we can talk a little bit about my foundation, too. But
I had
an opportunity to work with kids all through St. Paul because we offered my foundation offered the sport of lacrosse to all the parks in St. Paul.
Phelan Park?
Yeah, most of them, yeah, yep. Particularly on the east side. And I was so amazed at the diversity in St. Paul. And, you know, you go in certain sections, and it really brought a lot of joy to me to be able to work with kids of all ages and colors. And
if you took 7th Street to Payne Avenue,
okay, yeah,
and then
yeah.
went out to Phelan,
okay,
you go through about four different, maybe five different cultures.
Yes,
and
yes.
I have a convertible that I had since 1975, the year you got out of high school. I bought my very first and last convertible.
Yeah.
And I still have it.
Okay.
And I was taking, I think, my wife and my daughter and granddaughter, and we were cruising.
Okay.
And went up to St. Paul, and I showed them where all the places I lived. And we took Payne Avenue, and it was so much fun because it was Caucasian, it was African-American, mm-hmm. it was Vietnamese, mm-hmm. it was Hmong, it was Hispanic, mm-hmm. and the diversity, as you say, is pretty great.
Yeah, and it's amazing, too, because you get a chance to get integrated into their cultures as well, you know, and, you know, I'm introducing a game like lacrosse to all these cultures who have no idea, and that's where the joy was being able to give them something that they weren't really familiar with, but then certainly were curious about. And lacrosse is still mainly a suburban game across the country, but I think the dynamics of it are interesting to any kid.
Isn't that an expensive sport?
Well, you believe it is, but it's certainly not as expensive as football
or hockey.
But you do have to have a stick. You have to have goggles, and in the case of the boys' game, you have to have helmets and shoulder pads. So it can be expensive, but I think, like we mentioned before, you know, your parents have to really embrace this and be able to, you know, introduce this to kids, and it has to be part of the culture. You know, if the neighborhood kid down the street isn't playing lacrosse, you know, by and large, your kids aren't going to play either. So it hasn't been introduced fully, and quite naturally in most of the city schools, both in Minnesota, in Minneapolis and St. Paul, it's still not a sponsored sport per se. Minneapolis has a district team. St. Paul does not. So it's still in its infancy when it comes to the inner city influence.
Did you work with Humboldt High School on the west side of St. Paul?
No, I worked with just the parks, all the parks.
All the parks,
yeah,
all right.
So it was like 15 to 20 parks that we introduced these to.
Well, it would be on Baker Playground would have been the...
Would have, yeah. But, you know, I've worked with most of the St. Paul high schools as well.
Well, I used to, when I first came to Northfield, I found out there were a lot of people from St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a St. Paul night. This is like 2 years into doing the coming to Northfield, like 1970.
Okay.
We came here in 68. This would have been like 70. And I invited George Latimer, who was
the mayor
at the time. And I got Schmidt beer. And I got Ken's home-baked beans to supply things. People brought their own meat to grill. And every single high school in St. Paul was represented.
Because
I'd ask people to introduce themselves and what high school they went to or what their connection was. I was astounded. I mean, the parochial schools and the public schools.
Wow.
All living here in Northfield. Yeah. Kind of gives me goose pimples right now.
I bet. That, you know. Well, I mean, maybe having the two colleges in town influence these new inhabitants as well. I mean, they certainly, if they did go to college here, that they, you know, found the city appealing enough to stay. But that's interesting. That's good, though.
I'm going to take a break here. My guest this morning is Dr. Leo Lewis III. You may know his name as an individual who was on the very exciting. You were playing during the strike, weren't you?
Yeah, we had two strikes in the 80s.
Yeah, so. Okay. Excuse me. We'll be right back.
Capital Construction is Northfield's premier locally owned exterior construction company. Capital Construction is dedicated to the exterior commercial and residential transformations consisting of roofing, windows, siding, and gutters. It's never too early to start planning for the exterior transformation your house deserves. Everyone at Capital Construction hope you have a safe and happy holiday season filled with joy. Call Capital Construction today for a free consultation at 952-222-4004 or check them out at capitalconstruction-llc.com.
Hi, I'm Jackie, manager of Reflections End of Life Care Suites on the Three Links campus. At Reflections, we work with families and their loved ones to provide comfort care in our peaceful setting, with spacious suites, family areas, chapel, conservatory, and more. Our staff specialize in providing 24-hour nursing care to support your peace of mind. Please call Reflections at Three Links for more information about the care we provide at 664-8809 or find out more at threelinks.org.
Hello, everyone. This is your Action News reporter with all the news that is news across the nation on the scene at the supermarket. There seems to have been some disturbance here. Pardon me, sir. Did you see what happened?
Yeah, I did. I was standing over by the tomatoes, and here he come, running through the pole beans, through the fruits and vegetables, naked as a jaybird. And I hollered over to Ethel. I said, "Don't look, Ethel!" And it's too late. She'd already been incensed.
He comes.
Boogity, boogity.
There he goes.
You were a
boogity
junior in high school.
Oh, my God.
Did you remember this song, The Streak?
Yes, I do.
Did you ever do it?
No, sure didn't. But, you know, I think some of my high school teammates, not teammates, but schoolmates did. I remember one individual ran through the west side of the school, ran all the way through the school and exited the east side of the school and caught a car and left, you know. And at least that was a rumor, let's put it that way. But it's amazing how... you know, we conjure up things like that to make the years go by.
I remember when we had, I think 2 years back to back, we had streakers at the high school graduation. And it was up at St. Olaf on their campus 1 year, I remember. And here comes a streaker.
Yeah.
And there's a police officer that was probably much older than the streaker and maybe a little bit heavier than the streaker, and you could just see the streaker pulling away from the police officer, and it turned up to be my neighborhood kid who lived behind me. And
well, that may have been an extension of the whole sexual revolution thing, you know.
Oh, who knows?
Kind of express yourself, you know, and for whatever reason it was evident. Yeah, I remember that.
Okay, well, that's what I'm trying to do, is go down memory lane with you, and also what's happening now within your life and all that. It's Leo Lewis, Dr. Leo Lewis III, and I always like to, people that I don't know, there's always a connection, but now I've got an even bigger connection, because your dad and I were going to high school about the same time.
Yeah, I mean he would have been 85 this
year.
Oh,
okay. Well,
but at least you were there around the same time. I think I have some uncles, some of his younger brothers and sisters who are your age, and this is kind of a remembrance period for me. You know, I'm trying to recall a lot of the things that you know, my dad experienced, and, you know, he certainly wasn't around enough for me to get all the information, but it's always good to kind of hear from my aunts and uncles how things were back then. And, you know, I think another thing is that my cousins give me some reflection about how they lived when they were growing up in the 60s and 70s.
Well, have you ever gone to Rondo Days?
Yes, I have. Yes, okay. I have. And many of the individuals, adults and, you know, and elders, you know, I know from those areas, because I think that's where the concentration of African Americans were. And certainly my family, my extended family lived in those areas. And yeah, I had about eight of my aunts and uncles, you know, living in the Twin Cities.
My dad lived on Carroll Avenue.
Oh, okay.
And early after high school, I bounced around trying to figure out what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And a guy told me about an opening in the financial world.
Oh.
And that I could be a counselor for those in need of dollars. it was a small loan company, mm-hmm. and I thought I was going to be sitting at a desk wearing a tie and counseling people, loaning them money. I did a little bit of that. They gave me a bunch of cards and says, go collect.
Correct.
And I collected all over the Twin Cities. But I remember walking into a pool hall on Rondo Avenue, okay. I think right about Snelling in that area, in it's a black neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And here's a skinny white kid coming in. And in this pool hall, and when I walked in, you could hear a pin drop. Like, are you lost? And I was so naive. I go, hey, do you know a guy named Leo Lewis? And it just was like...
it was a pretty good experience, wasn't it? Interesting. You remembered it.
And you know what? I didn't have fear.
Yeah.
I just thought, oh... There is a difference, you know. I mean, just like I'm sure that the exact opposite has happened, you know, obviously.
Was this before Highway 94 was was built?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. This would have been in the 50s, when early 60s.
Because I think just recently they've really reprised some of the memory of Rondo Avenue and, you know, certainly have been trying to make it more of a landmark by establishing outposts around the area so people can remember it. And, you know, it's part of the Historical Society's vision lately to get people to understand the whole effect of having Highway 94 go through neighborhoods and through downtown. And, my grandparents weren't affected because their home was in Carroll Avenue, which is a block or two over going south. But I do know families and individuals who represented families who, you know, certainly had to move a number of times, let alone move out of the neighborhood.
It was what they called in the industry financing through redlined.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And and I was around watching the population of that Rondo neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Moving up past Marshall,
okay.
and then past Selby, then down to Summit, and then down to Grand.
Okay.
And, now that's the way it is, you know. But it was like, oh.
Mm-hmm.
I'm old enough to remember living in Indianapolis that drinking fountains,
mm-hmm.
swimming pools.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm that old,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And I'm glad that I've seen the way things have changed in a positive way. Probably not enough, but still, they are better than when I was a kid.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I tell my students I'm a product of segregation. You know, it hasn't been that long ago, and when I started school, I went to segregated schools in Columbia, Missouri, and it's important because it does reflect history. But, you know, when we talk about sport, for example, it reflects how sport was segregated up until as late as the early 70s, you know. And, we look at in football, college football right now, and, you know, the Southeastern Conference was the last conference to integrate in the early 1970s. And, you've got Alabama, you know, has a black quarterback. I mean, the evolution of the game has changed, but certainly the dynamic has
I'm from the Doug Williams. I remember being down in Miami,
mm-hmm.
and the Vikings were playing.
Okay.
And I don't know if that was in your era or not.
Yeah.
But I was down on the field, and man, that Doug Williams was first NFL quarterback, right? Starting quarterback.
No, he was the first. He wasn't the first black quarterback to start in the NFL, but he was the first black quarterback to win the Super Bowl.
Okay,
and they beat us. They beat the Vikings in the NFC Championship.
Yeah, and I was down there.
Yeah,
and I always thought he was the first starting black quarterback in the NFL. I don't know why I had that. Yeah. But anyhow, I watched that game, and boy, was he good.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an era when people were wondering, hey, you know.
Yeah,
so,
he encountered a lot of racism, certainly, because he went to Tampa he was drafted by Tampa, which, you know, it could be considered the South to an extent. But, I just think that it's been great to in this country to be able to identify talent regardless, you know. And at the same time, you know, sport reflects our culture at large. And I think sometimes we use sport as a divider or a way to institute more fair play and you know, certainly, you know, an even playing field. And oftentimes sport is can be an influencer in social justice as well. So it's certainly been a good opportunity in my career to be able to meet folks of all walks of life and to have friends in all walks of life. And you know, particularly when you play on a college and professional team, you know, you get teammates who are from all across the country, and you get to understand them and where they came from as well.
I just came up with another connection.
What's that?
Did your dad play sports at Mechanic Arts?
No, he's at Marshall High School.
Well, where does Mechanic Arts come in? Why do I keep thinking that?
Well, it was in the area. I mean, it was the other high school that replaced, from my vantage point, replaced Marshall.
Well,
because it was in the same area. But and I know it well because my uncles and my dad's brothers and sisters went to Mechanic Arts as well. But
more by the cathedral area than by the Capitol area.
Right. But Dad was an all-city performer in basketball, track, and football. And, you know, he's a little guy just like me, but he was about 5'10". He weighed about 93-95 pounds, so he was a running back. Mm-hmm. But, you know, certainly was a scat back as well and had a long career in the Canadian Football League. And it is interesting that, you know, some of his teammates, Frank Gilliam, for example, was the head scout for the Vikings at the time when I played. And then certainly Bud and a couple, you know, Burns, Jerry Burns was a guest coach for the Bombers at the time, and you know, certainly became, you know, my offensive coach and then my head coach at the Vikings. So there's a lot of good connections there, and you know, I feel very fortunate that it occurred that way. But you know, certainly anytime you make a professional team, it's because you did the work on the field. It wasn't necessarily because of favorites or, you know, because you know, the coach necessarily liked you. I mean, you still had to perform, and so I was given that opportunity finally.
Do you think the pros nowadays, and I'm saying nowadays, I don't mean to age you, but...
Yeah. Well, it's been 26 years since I played, so
okay.
You can age me if you want.
Do you think that the... of course, as you know, having worked on the high school level, the tendency seems to be not be a baseball, hockey, mm-hmm. football... player, you concentrate on one particular discipline. That isn't the way it was when you were in high school back in the 70s.
No, it wasn't.
You played everything, didn't you?
Well, I tried, every season. I mean, there's usually three seasons in school sports. But I think it depends on, you know, the school. If you're at a smaller school, you're going to get athletes who are going to compete more in one sport. And they may be certainly good at another sport, but, you know, these teams need their presence. And, you know, more than likely, if you're a good athlete, you can perform in all three at a high level in your school. You know, if you're at a big suburban school, it may not be the same. But I still believe, you know, these athletes nowadays still compete in more than one sport. But they have that one sport that they focus a lot on, and for example, if you're a basketball player, you're more than likely, if you're good, you're going to play in the summer, maybe AAU ball, for example. Or if you're a baseball player, you're going to play American Legion in the summer. You know, certainly football is different, but you know, if you're an ice hockey player, you're going to play all year round as well, regardless of what interest you might have in other sports. But I think, you know, by the time you're in your 10th grade, you pretty much are given signals that you're, you know, where your talent is really best suited. And you get a chance to kind of understand the industry a little bit because you're eligible to be recruited at that time. And up until then, you're not getting letters from colleges, even though I keep hearing that as far down to seventh grade, these student athletes are getting hints or information from colleges that, you know, that have piqued their interest.
Sure.
And sometimes when you play outstate or across you know, state lines, you get a lot of that interest because you're playing, you're being seen by more people. And it's not unheard of to have college recruiters come and watch you play before you get to the 10th grade.
We had North Carolina basketball coach, scout, I should say, at Northfield High School last Friday night, and he was looking at this kid from Rochester.
Well, the colleges can do anything they want. It really depends on whether they make contact with you or not. But, yeah, colleges can come and watch you as a fourth grader if they want. You know, it doesn't matter. But I think it really depends on how they establish that communication with the family and you.
I got some other questioning that I want to do.
Okay.
But I have to take a final break this hour.
No problem.
Leo Lewis is my guest on the Wayne Eddy Affair, Minnesota Viking in the 80s. In addition to that, he is a professor at the University of Minnesota.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas here at the KYMN studios. We're bringing a little joy to the world with prizes for our listeners. Santa Claus is coming to town with local area gift certificates for flowers and clothing, auto care and sports, and a whole lot more. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer has Northfield area chamber bucks for every winner. Even the Grinch has stocked KYMN with treats for your pets and you. Listen to the KYMN Morning Show, 6 to 9 every weekday, now through December 21st, for your chance to win. When you hear Santa say, ho, 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 Merry Christmas, be the third caller and win. Listen to 95 The One, AM 1080, and streaming at kymnradio.net. Then call 507-645-5695.
The holiday season is here, filled with blessings of wonder and cheer. At Northfield Retirement Community, we value the traditions of this very special time and are happy to be sharing them with our residents, our families, staff, and friends. The halls are decked with ribbons and bows, and joyful music abundantly flows. From all of us at Northfield Retirement Community, we'd like to wish you and your families a safe, happy, and heartfelt Merry Christmas. Northfield Retirement Community. Innovation. Choice. Tradition.
The staff at the Archer House River Inn in downtown Northfield wishes you and yours a very happy, prosperous holiday season. And thank you, patrons, for the support you've given throughout the year. If you're looking for charm, the upscale Archer House River Inn is one of the best hotels in town. Merry Christmas from the Archer House River Inn.
You were a junior in high school. This was the ninth most popular song in 1974 when you were a junior. You know it?
I recall it. I don't remember who played it, but I recall it.
MFSB is the name of the group.
Okay.
MFSB. You know what that stands for?
No.
Mother, father, sister, brother.
That's right. Tell you what, that was the explosion of music at that particular time in the 70s and
this
early
is 80s. The sound of Philadelphia.
Yes.
Well, it's 10 o'clock here on the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN Radio out of Northfield, Minnesota, the home of Cows, Colleges, and Contentment. We are 1080 on your AM dial, and that's for over 50 years, and we are at 95.1 FM, and we are with Dr. Leo Lewis III, and we're going to take a brief break for a look at the news, and we'll be back in just a moment.
The man accused of fatally shooting Minnesota Duluth student William Grayheck claims he never went inside the victim's home on Valentine's Day 2017. The trial of DeAndre Davenport began Wednesday, and his attorney told jurors that co-defendant Noah Baker acted alone in the botched attempt to rob Grayheck of drugs and money, and his client is innocent. Minnesota is gearing up to host another championship sporting event. The Target Center in Minneapolis will play host to the 2018 NCAA Women's Volleyball Championship beginning today. Matt Munier with Sports Minneapolis says recent renovations to the venue and recent successes like the Super Bowl and NCAA Frozen Four made this the perfect time.
It'll literally be 30 years since the last time. So for us, it's a really unique opportunity to showcase that we are a championship host city, that volleyball is incredibly important to our region. We just can't wait to host.
This is MNN.
Come on, baby. Do
I come to your point? No,
come on.
Because I'm too loud.
Are you?
Should you be that loud?
Let's see. What did I do here? I can't hear me, but I'm working. Something happened. Here we go. Stick with me. Sorry about that, Leo.
No problem.
I unplugged something here. You know this song.
Man, I remember all those songs. I just don't have the name with it. But okay. That's quite a long time ago.
Well, that's true. It's Grand Funk
Railroad.
Yeah, and it's called The Locomotion.
Okay.
2 minutes after 10 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair, and my guest this morning is Dr. Leo Lewis III, and we are just chatting, chit-chatting about a lot of different things, I'd like to ask people like you and others like Stu Voigt and the rest of them, the compensation that players are getting, including offensive linemen.
Yeah.
I remember the first $1 million offensive lineman was Boyd, I think, from the Vikings.
Brent Boyd.
And that was a big, big deal.
I bet. And, you know, I don't think it was.
And Wade
average.
Wilson was the first millionaire for the Vikings.
Well, he and Anthony Carter, Steve Jordan, and then later on it was Keith Millard and Chris Dolman.
You
they
just
all,
did what I did.
were on the pinnacle of this new compensation change. And I think it coincided with free agency, which the NFL started in 1993. And, you know, free agency for some is good, for others maybe not. I think what it ended up doing was made it much better for the elite players, the top players. And the average players didn't see much of a rise in their salary, but that's just it. I mean, even now, you know, you have almost $100 million players on these teams, and you got quite a few who make a fraction of that, and that's just the way it goes. It's a corporate model where the people at the top make the most and take most of the percentage of the salary cap, and they're just as human as anyone else.
But didn't something happen in the NFL where the veterans were complaining that the rookies that didn't even make the team
of
yet
were
getting paid more money than the veterans were? Didn't they get that where now as a rookie you play for the minimum but you get a signing bonus? Or I
think
don't
in
know
some leagues it's like that, maybe in the NBA and Major League Baseball, but in NFL, I mean, you're getting the rookies becoming millionaires almost immediately before they even get to the season. And I don't know if that will ever change because of the volatility in the NFL. I mean, it doesn't matter how good you are. If you can't get on the field or if you're injured, you know, you're not going to be worth anything. And, you know, there's a lot of money on the sidelines usually that doesn't help you.
You're a man of ethics. And what stories do you know about college kids getting a house for mom or a car for dad or whatever it is? I remember talking to one Viking when I was doing a visit with the Vikings in the mornings, and the person told me that his mother was driving a white Cadillac in a very depressed area.
Of course.
And did you ever observe that, see it?
Well, not to that extent, but I think, you know, in the popular media, you get a lot of incidences where this is evident, And but I know for sure when young people who often see that, you know, their talent is valued, they tend to incorporate people to surround them around, you know, their goals. And, you know, we see it evident today where, I mean, which is probably depressing, but at the same time, you can understand it. These young people who have decided not to play with their team in the bowl games and yet want to get themselves prepared and to risk injury
before they go to the
draft.
You're talking about the University of Minnesota.
Yeah, but it's happened all through the country. You know, I think the Big Ten Network had a list of individuals from many of the Big Ten teams who were doing the same thing. And, you know, you wish them well. I mean, you know, let's be honest. You know, a kid can always graduate from college. They can always come back and graduate. It's not going to ever be a barrier to them. And quite frankly, the schools want them to graduate because they're measured on those metrics as well. But at the same time, I think you're abandoning your teammates in a time where it's probably the most appropriate and most fun-filled time of the year, and that's to play in a bowl game. So I can see both sides. There's no doubt about that. But again, we're looking at a lot of individuals who aren't going to be in the top 10 of the draft. They may not even be first round draft choices, and they're saving themselves for workouts with pro scouts. And at the same time, they're saving themselves from having to go to school. So they're using the next 4 months to just get in shape. So
and then that rolls over to the Division I schools, mm-hmm. that are using athletes to raise money, and they're not compensating the athletes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's minimal, and it used to be under the table. They got your car from a car dealership that was doing this and that. But, I mean, that's a lot of work. You're at the university.
Yeah.
Those guys are working year-round.
Yes, they are.
And
they're
getting an education, mm-hmm. and if they're going to Carleton or St. Olaf, that's a lot of money.
Correct.
Every year. I don't know what the U costs now for, mm-hmm. a regular.
Yeah, it's in the 20s.
Okay.
Yep.
So do you think that what would happen if they did get paid?
Yeah, and I'm an advocate for that. I think that the industry makes so much money off of these individuals, and you can say they're exploited, but you can also say that they get some perks for being a student athlete. But, you know, if I can recall, man, all those days where I was injured and the next day after the game trying to go to school and go to class and focus on my studies, it's very hard to do that when you're injured and depressed because maybe you lost or didn't play enough. I mean, I think the emotional toll is probably the most evident to the detriment of the student athlete. And nowadays, the student athletes are going to school all year round. Most of them are, meaning they're going to summer school, and it gives them an opportunity to train all year round as well, which may or may not be advantageous for the body and for the mindset. And so I think what happened when I was going to school, and, you know, that's some years back, but, you know, certainly all the way up until maybe the mid-90s, you know, individual student athletes were able to work and try an alternative career in the summer, maybe get an internship at a good company and grow on another career path while they were student athletes. And nowadays, you don't see that too often. As a matter of fact, you see a lot of student athletes graduating early with no work experience whatsoever because they don't have an opportunity to do that. And another phenomenon is that you're seeing a lot of professional athletes who don't go back to finish their degree because they have obligations with their team in the off season. And quite frankly, the college degree isn't as valued by them as it used to be. And it's not valued through the Players Association as well as the league. So I think we're understanding that this whole industry is more institutionalized than we think, in that it starts when you're in the 10th grade, if you're a great athlete, and it continues until, you know, you find out that you can't play anymore. But for those who can play all the way through the pros, they're institutionalized in a way that they have to fit a certain progressional process to be able to be successful at each of these levels.
Yesterday, I had the head football coach of St. Olaf College on the air, K Killiam, James Killiam.
Okay.
I had him on the week before that, and he tried out for the NFL, played Europe.
Okay.
Did they have Europe programs when you were
No, Europe but the Europe? NFL had a league in Europe for a number of years in the 90s. And, you know, they're not there now, although they do play regular season games there. But, no, I never was influenced. I went to Canada for a year.
This guy, this coach, Killiam, graduated from high school in 1999.
Okay.
Then he played for Oklahoma, Tulsa.
Okay.
And then he went to Europe. He was a quarterback.
Okay.
I did it again yesterday. I did the same thing. I was saying you were a quarterback club.
Oh, okay.
And so I used to say quarterback club. So the opportunity to teach these young men and mm-hmm. women that aren't jocks or
correct,
and teach them about the harmony and the disharmony or whatever mm-hmm. about the culture of athletics on a professional level and a college level gives them a better understanding of who these people are other than headlines.
Of course.
And so what about North? Mm-hmm. You know, there's weren't you the AD at North?
Yeah, I was. I was there for about 4 years, and, you know, certainly came at a good time where we, you know, our basketball and football teams were able to gain championships at the state level and, you know, certainly in a district that you know, didn't provide a lot of opportunity, but we, you know, we certainly had an opportunity to raise money to help our sports team.
Well, you kind of brought it back to life, didn't you?
Well, I was part of it. I mean, I think we had good coaching. We had enterprising athletic directors group that really looked to be progressive in trying to provide opportunities for student athletes in all the schools. And we were successful at the time.
So what's the end result of that? Because there are some people that have a negative feeling, mm-hmm. and I don't know.
Well, it's always going to be what that neighborhood wants in their neighborhood school, and it's fitting for every school in the state. You know, it really does require parental support, requires corporate or business support, requires some leadership from the district as well, and I think, you know, it's no different than other schools. I mean, even in the suburban schools, you have fundraising as a key element to the success of a program. It doesn't matter what school it is. If it's a public school, they're going to be in the need of financial support from outside the school community, and I think it's going to be best suited when you have a student body that reflects you know, an economic force that's a lot greater than other districts like, you know, in Minneapolis. But I think that, you know, the whole notion of high school athletics, intercollegiate athletics, is based on what that culture wants of that community and that school. And, you know, some focus on other sports, some are more well-rounded and have the capacity through either facilities or the coaching to rise at greater heights, and you find that in the more lucrative districts.
Of
you
course.
Find that they can offer more opportunities.
Minnetonka.
Of course.
Eden Prairie.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, my daughters went to Eden Prairie, and they had the opportunity to excel in sports, but so did a lot of other kids. I mean, I can recall my daughters playing soccer, and they had four soccer teams for girls, you know. And at the same time, they still had to cut, you know. But at some other schools, you know, you don't have a cut policy because you want to get as many individuals to participate as possible. And that's healthy. I think it does become endemic in a healthy environment for the school.
Well, now, in our school district, you know, Bubba Sullivan, he doesn't cut.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of kids get an opportunity to be there when they're successful and be there when they lose, mm-hmm. have that experience, although
right.
they may not get any minutes.
Of course.
I know that's only used to basketball, but you know what I mean.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And then you get to the basketball, you can only carry so many.
Yeah.
And I got cut from basketball and broke my heart.
Yeah.
I wasn't any good, but I wanted to play basketball.
Of course.
Now, you being having a doctorate degree and taking school seriously, mm-hmm. Was your position then in the high school level at North, for example, education, athletic ability is important, but
Well, learn. Of course. I mean, that's always the message. You know, regardless of whether you're at the high school level, youth level, grassroots level, is more of a participatory sport. So it's kind of you know, without constraints. But even at the professional level, I think you want to get that athlete to understand this is just a fleeting moment in terms of your entire life. You know, most athletes at the professional level just want to make as much money as they can doing something that they love. At the college level, yeah, it is an educational process. At the high school level, you know, officials believe that sports is a educational participatory endeavor, and it could be a platform by which you educate your students as well. So I think at all those levels, you learn, and you learn how to be an adult, particularly in college and at the pro level, because no one's going to hold your bucket, hold your weight. You're going to have to do it yourself, you know, and particularly academically.
Yeah.
So I think one of the things that I've grown to know in all of those experiences as a student athlete and professional athlete is that hard work almost always prevails. I think that, you know, not being a high draft choice, you know, not having a large stature, you know, I had to work and be at 100% of my game almost all the time. And to have anything less than that was going to be not good for me.
Does that moniker Little Leo Lewis bother you?
Not really. I think it's probably an affectionate way. You know, there was a St. Louis sports writer who coined that when I was in college, and you know, it just happened to rhyme well, you know, yeah. with my names.
Yeah.
But you know, I think that I always turn things around to say, well, you know, if I wasn't on the field, they wouldn't name it anyway. So it's always good to hear that because I think it's more done affectionately than
yeah,
well, it is to demean.
That's what's in my craw. You know, I always because I really admired you. And your work ethics and mm-hmm. attitude and your performance on the field. Mm-hmm. And when you stood up, stood next to the guy in the locker room
yeah.
that was 6'5",
yeah.
you know, I go, oh, yeah, that's what, well, how tall are you?
Like I'm 5'8".
Five, eight.
You know, there's still guys.
And a wide receiver.
Yes, a wide receiver. And, you know, during that day, during the 80s, the small wide receiver was in vogue. I mean, I think that I remember seeing Warren Moon play for the Houston Oilers, and all of his receivers were my size, and they caught tons of balls. I was really jealous because he threw the ball a lot, where we had more of a standard offense. And I think to a certain extent, there are guys my size that are still playing in the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
And I always say, you know, I can't block a defensive end. But, you know, a 6'5", 290-pound offensive lineman can't go down and run a post pattern either. So, I mean, we all kind of have our niche,
mm-hmm.
and I was very, very fortunate to be able to find my niche.
I'm fascinated by the intelligence it takes
mm-hmm.
and how there have been wonderful physiques, physically capable individuals,
yeah.
but they just couldn't get it and would go off sides or
uh-huh.
go the wrong way. And,
yeah.
and I imagine they pound that into your head in practice, and
uh-huh.
the quarterback has to know all of everybody's responsibilities. And what were some of the plays that they called? I mean, like yellow, red, wide right.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, what were some
well,
that you remember?
What I don't remember calls? Any of them. I tell
you
what, I've been out of football so long, Wayne, it's unbelievable. But that's a good thing, though. I think, you know, let me say this. The plays indicated specific duties. So, you know, and every team has a lexicon of terms that they use to distinguish themselves from the other team, so that if the other team heard, they wouldn't necessarily know what was going on. So by and large, yes, you have to have some sense of intelligence to be able to go through hundreds of plays and to memorize them to an extent where when you get out there, it just becomes immediately acceptable, and you can, you know, learn it instinctively. So I think that one of the things that helped me was that I was able to learn more than one position. And I think that qualifies me as being to say that if someone got injured, then they were confident enough to say, hey, you know, if Leo's on the bench, he can fill in at this particular position too.
As a Viking?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, you're a wide receiver.
But there are other wide receiver positions, you know. I mean, if I were to line up on the left, you know, there's another position on the right that is not, you know, that has a different role on that play. Okay, and you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that just because I was a wide receiver that I didn't run the ball off a handoff from the quarterback, or you know, pass the ball. I mean, in college, I passed the ball from a wide receiver position.
Oh, wow, that'd be
so
fun.
So, I mean, there's some elements there based upon your skill level as to what you can do, but by and large, yes, it's a very difficult, you know, if you came from Europe and came over here and wanted to learn how American football worked, it would be very difficult for you to understand all the intricacies in this game. And because you have 22 different positions out there, it does get to be a very difficult game to master as well. And I think that's one of the stumbling blocks for all professional athletes. It doesn't matter how big you are sometimes. It really matters. Can the coach be confident that when you get out there and run the play that you're going to execute the play well? And it does become a much more of a physical game, too. You can know what to do, but if you get overpowered by someone, that's going to be a negative play for you as well. So when I left the game, I really understood more about how difficult it was and how physically demanding it was. And every sport has their demands, but professional football is just the ultimate when it comes to what's demanded of you and your body.
Yeah. You must remember your call when you knew that. Oh, by the way, name the quarterbacks that you played with.
Well, I came in and Tommy Kramer was the starting quarterback.
Okay. Number 11.
And Steve Dills was his backup.
Yeah. Okay.
And, you know, Steve broke a Vikings record for passing in one game. He threw 62 passes in one game that we lost. And then, you know, Wade Wilson came in the same year I came in, so he eventually was the starter. And we acquired Rich Gannon later on, and Rich and Wade were battling it out once Tommy left. And then Sean Salisbury was in the mix. So we had this trifecta of quarterbacks that we had to deal with during the late 80s. When I left, and you know, I think Rich ended up leaving. Eventually, Wade left when Warren Moon came. I think Coach Green, Dennis Green, hired Warren Moon to come in as the quarterback. And there's been a number of quarterbacks since then. But while I was playing, you know, Wade Wilson, Tommy Kramer were the main quarterbacks.
Tommy Kramer, I used to remember. I'd call you guys up at 8:15 in the morning.
In the morning on the radio, yeah.
And by the way, I feel that since I started doing that in 70, I think, and now jocks are all over the media.
Oh, no doubt.
You know,
yeah.
But back then it was you want Alan Page.
Okay.
8:15 in the morning.
Yeah.
Yeah. No way.
Yeah, no.
He wasn't going to do that, but. What I was going to say, the connection. Okay, Tommy Kramer, mm-hmm. party guy, mm-hmm. married a gal from Austin,
okay,
Minnesota, and I called him one morning on a Monday.
Okay,
and I had after about 3 minutes say, Tommy, you think we should do this some other time?
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
And then Sean Salisbury. Uh-huh. Now I really liked him. And he came down to Northfield, and he Christmas shopped, and he bought his wife some clothes from the Dollhouse, which isn't open anymore, but uh-huh. I liked that. Was Chuck Nelson a kicker when
yes,
you were
Yes, he was.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
He came down and shopped and did a grand opening for Mr. Movies at the time. But Salisbury ended up on television.
Yes, he did.
And then I noticed that... I thought, I want to, you know, I had him on my show. I kind of introduced him to broadcasting.
Right.
Like Stu Voigt and several others. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, it was a pay channel. I couldn't believe it. It seems like I got every channel that you can get.
Okay.
But the Sean Salisbury show was one you had to pay extra for.
Oh, wow.
I went, huh.
Yeah.
So now Gannon, of course, I married Bill Brown's daughter.
Of course.
Now, are you still in touch with...
Somewhat. You know, he's still a very busy man. He's on Sirius at XM with his show. And, you know, he still does commentary for some of the networks as well. You know, he's, heavily involved with a lot of the NFL stuff that's going on. I don't see him as much as I used to, certainly. It's good that he's kept his home in the Twin Cities. And, you know, his wife and he have a family to raise. But, you know, he's one of the many of former Vikings that live in the Twin Cities still that you know, call it our home. And, you know, I've been there 35 years, and it's just been a great place to live. You know, certainly we've got the winters, but, you know, there's extremes everywhere, you know. Not to say that I won't move, but, there's extremes everywhere. You know, who wants to be in Florida, you know, during the spring and summer when those hurricanes came through?
Yeah.
I think that that's as scary as having 12 inches of snow, to tell you the truth. But I think that one of the things that I've always cherished were former teammates, even at the college level. We this year we celebrated our 40th year at the University of Missouri of our 1978 Liberty Bowl win against LSU, and there were literally former teammates that I hadn't seen since then. So I hadn't seen in 40 years.
And turned pro?
One named Steve Hamilton was my roommate. He was drafted by the 49ers back then. But another guy that was a roommate of mine that I see frequently is Kellen Winslow, who was a tight end Hall of Famer from the San Diego Chargers, you know, played with Dan Fouts. And he's a special assistant to a college in Michigan, you know, has a law degree and has been doing well.
Who was your roommate in Mankato and on the road?
You know, my roomies in Mankato.
You got a big smile on your face.
You know, Greg Coleman, which we all know, was a roommate toward the end of my career. And then, you know, he left in the mid-'80s. And then after that, we had our own rooms. But before that, my first roommate was Jarvis Redwine. He was a running back that was drafted in 82. And he and I were roommates. And, you know, he's a fast running back from Nebraska who had excellent speed. He ended up returning kicks for us sparingly, but got injured and had a progressive injury that never panned it out. So Jarvis Redwine and Greg Coleman were my roommates.
Okay. Greg Coleman did shows for me out of Mankato.
Okay.
And Stu Boyd did them out of Mankato.
Yep.
And there's another quarterback that did it for me because I remember meeting him on 169 in Highway 19 to give him the tape recorder and stuff.
Oh, wow.
And I can't remember if I heard it, I'd know it. We have to take a break. Our guest this morning is Dr. Leo Lewis III, and affectionately called Little Leo Lewis, and a wide receiver for the Vikings for almost a decade or 11 years.
11 years, yeah.
11 years, wow.
This holiday, take everything you love about Christmas and wrap it in red. Hi, this is Dan from Aeroways Hardware in Northfield. We have the perfect gifts at the perfect price. Come on in for top brands like Weber grills, Steel, and Toro snowblowers. Plus, get the trusted advice you've come to rely on. Get ready for the holidays at your neighborhood Aero Ace, the helpful place. Now through Christmas Eve, round up or donate at Aero Ace Hardware to help our local food shelf, the Community Action Center of Northfield.
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
At this very special time of year, Schmidt Homes and Schmidt Homes Remodeling would like to take the time to wish you a warm season's greetings and the very best wishes for the upcoming year. If you're in the market for the ultimate gift of a new home or newly remodeled kitchen, Schmidt Homes Remodeling and Schmidt Homes will work with you on projects big and small to design and build your dreams. Happy holidays to friends old and new from Schmidt Homes and Schmidt Homes Remodeling.
You're getting married. Congratulations. Now let's talk invitations. Should they be traditional, contemporary, or rustic? Do you need inspiration or looking for something outside the box? from your save the date to your thank you and everything in between, By All Means Graphics will help you define your style to fit the tone of your wedding. From design to can you print what someone made for me, we're here to help. By All Means Graphics is located in downtown Northfield at 17 Bridge Square. Stop on in to meet with one of our team members or call us at 507-663-7937 to set up an appointment. You can also find us online at byallmeansgraphics.com.
You know the name of this one?
No, I do not.
Well, I can help.
I recall it, though. I recall.
I can help.
So. If you got a problem, oh my gosh, no. Don't care what it is. You need a hand,
I can assure you this. I can help. I can help, Billy Swan. Brings back some nice memories.
Yes,
huh?
It does.
Junior in high school.
Oh, man. It would sure
do me good. Leo Lewis is my guest here this... I did it again. What? I don't understand why that. There we go. Okay. Yeah. 1032 on 1080 Radio. Leo Lewis, my guest on KYMN Radio, having a lot of fun right now. He's a professor at the University of Minnesota, and he is a former wide receiver for the Vikings and also was athletic director. Is that the title you
had? Well, I was athletic director at University of Minnesota.
Oh,
you
yeah, remember? That's right. Last time you were here, director. You were
yeah.
there.
Yeah. yeah.
Who now, was...
Joel Maturi was the athletic director.
Yeah, I had
time.
Him on my show.
Oh, good.
And but we had a common friend, Ryan.
Paul Ryan.
Not
but
Tom.
But he's in the athletic athletic department still.
Yeah,
he's been there over almost 30 years now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
but those are some good old days. That was pre. Sports park days. Now, you know, if you go on the campus right now, their sports park is just immaculate. It's state of the art, as it should be. You know, that's the only way you're going to compete nowadays in intercollegiate athletics. And now we're two ADs removed from Joel Maturi, and things are different. Things are different. And I'm happy though to be able to still be on campus and work with that population of students and, you know, get them to understand a little bit more about the facts of sport and particularly at the intercollegiate athletic level.
Is the NFL helping retired players?
For the first time, I would say that there has been a resurgence and consciousness that has been raised for former players, and I think it's been spurred on by the whole concussion mm-hmm. dilemma and issue, and the fact that many of my teammates as well,
Wally
many former players have really succumbed to this effect of concussions, and like I said, some of my teammates have, and you know, I certainly, you know, Fred McNeil died as well,
yeah.
and I think it just is apparent. I'm not sure how pervasive it is, but I think it has sparked the interest of the NFL and the NFL Players Association to address these issues, and not so much to address it after it is diagnosed, but to have more preventative measures in place. And we see it in the current game right now. They've relaxed the rules a little bit to support, you know, concussions and collisions on the field. But I think overall the advent of services for all of us has improved greatly. And I've really been happy with that. And I'm glad, certainly.
You mentioned number 54. Fred McNeil,
mm-hmm.
who became an attorney.
Yeah. yeah.
And what a nice guy. Mm-hmm. What a great guy. I was shocked when he passed away.
Yeah. It just goes to show you that the illness doesn't matter who you are. I mean, if you've played, in this instance, I think people have concluded that if you've played football to any extent, you're a candidate, you know.
Mick Tinglehoff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Several others. Wally Hilgenberg,
mm-hmm. right,
and it's certainly unfortunate, but we have something that I say that we always have a connect. I mean, all my guests are somehow, some way connect. You know, like your dad went to Marshall, my dad
yes.
went to Central, and
oh,
same
okay.
neighborhood. So here's the connect. Now, you come to Northfield more than for the Wayne Eddy affair, correct?
Yeah, of course.
You want to do the connect on it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know a family here that I've gotten to know for a couple years. My partner is from Northfield, and you know she now works in the cities, and it's brought me here because her parents live here, and it's been good to get to know their family and you know see Northfield from a different perspective.
You're not going to mention the name?
No.
Okay. All right.
I can't do that without their permission.
Okay. I almost did,
but I tell you what. But I tell you what though. You know, you and I have been connected for a long time. I remember way back in 1988, I did some clinics down here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I asked you about, you know, how fruitful that would be and whether it was, you know, good to do that. And certainly you agreed. And you know, I brought some of my Vikings teammates down here. And I think that it went over really well. We ended up coming a couple years, I believe.
Yeah.
And that kind of spurred me on to do some of these camps and clinics all over the state. And, you know, I think one of the things about the out-state regions is that they really appreciate the Vikings and any professional players coming to their community and being able to be a positive light for the kids. And, you know, and yeah, I can see where maybe, you know, communities such as Northfield don't get a chance to be embraced by the Viking players. And, you know, quite notably, you don't see it as much as you used to. But it was good to be able to again, get what ended up starting to be the foundations for my youth foundation, which is a 501c3.
And I should give a shout out to the Northfield Lions Club because they were the ones that
okay.
helped sponsor that.
Okay.
Because you had scholarships.
Yes.
So
yes.
anybody could go and you would take them on
mm-hmm.
if they didn't have the money.
Right.
I think it was $25.
Yeah, it wasn't much. Yeah. It wasn't much.
And the Lions covered it.
Yeah.
And, okay, that's number one. Number two, I'm going to tell you a story. Now, you don't want me to mention their names.
Okay.
you're sure I can't?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, a lot of people listening know them. Anyhow, I'll tell you a story.
Okay.
Your partner has sisters.
Yes.
When they were little,
okay.
and I'm talking little,
yeah.
we're talking back in the early 70s
yeah.
maybe, they were, the football coach here in Northfield at the time was a guy named Don Hill,
okay.
who ended up being the president of the Minnesota Education
oh.
And he for one term, and
okay.
then he changed the rules to make it two terms, then he got the rules changed to make it three
oh, no.
terms. And then he ended up being the CEO in Rhode Island
okay.
for the teachers union.
Oh, then he got out of here.
Yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, he's still here.
Oh, and, is he?
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And
okay.
I have him in every once in a while. He's
yeah.
a fascinating guy. I like the guy. Anyhow, he used to put on a aqua show and at the Northfield swimming pool.
Okay.
And he involved all the kids.
Yeah.
And the lady that we're talking about
yeah.
and her sisters
yeah.
were aqua tots.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Now, tot being the youngest
really, yeah.
group.
Of course.
And my job was to work with Don Hill and be the backstage manager.
Yeah, yeah.
But
man, you were everywhere, weren't you?
Yeah.
You did everything.
Well, you know, and so, but I also had the responsibility of the tiny tots.
Okay.
So I'm wearing headphones listening to the coach telling
yeah.
me to get this act ready and that act ready
right.
and all that. And then I had to get these aqua tots that I had to rehearse with them and all
okay.
that. And your friend
yeah.
and her sisters wore these little inner tubes.
Yeah. Oh, my
And they
God.
Would, to the music, they would jump off the edge of the pool.
Okay.
And I swear to God, they could
really?
Walk underneath this table here.
Unbelievable.
The littlest one.
Unbelievable.
And they turned out to be the most beautiful young women.
Well, I'm going to have to challenge them to tell me that. Extend that
well,
story and tell
you,
me a little bit about
you
their
know,
experiences.
I think maybe the youngest one won't remember. The
yeah.
oldest one hopefully does remember because
okay.
it was a lot of fun.
Okay, yeah.
And
oh, great.
I'm going to have people up and down the street Wayne, who are you talking about?
I know. And that's good, though. That's good. That'd be your next story.
Yeah. I said, well, and I'll tell them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, tell me about the Jesse James deal, man. I'd like to know some little history of that. You're not doing that anymore?
No. To be a professional football player, to score a touchdown is macho, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you still...
It's gratifying. Let's tell you that much.
And it's macho. Well, when you ride with the Raiders,
okay,
and I did that for over 25 years, to get on a horse and to wear pistols on your hips, to wear a duster and a cowboy hat, if you will, and ride into town, get off your horse, go into the bank, rob the bank, and come out and shoot them up and remount and shoot them up as you're leaving town.
Oh, my God.
Is probably the most adrenaline feeling I've ever had. Uh-huh. And I've skydived. So, you never knew what the horse was going to do. I had my share of accidents. And I don't do it anymore when I... when I lost my leg, people that were in charge of the event, they didn't want me riding in there because who knows what could
happen.
That's right. And I have to tell you, on one hand, I was very disappointed because I worked hard to be able to do that. And the other hand, I was glad that they wouldn't let me. Have you ever done that in a football game where you got... on one hand, you want to get in there and play, but on the other hand, you don't want to be bruised by some big linebacker.
What? No, I don't think it happened during the game, but I do recall how I felt, you know, when I finished my career, in that, you want a coach to want you, you know, and by the time I finished with the Vikings, you know, Jerry Burns was fired, and then it wasn't until that January that they hired Dennis Green. You know, and you just didn't feel like you were needed or wanted. And, you know, all I was disappointed in the possibility of my career ending, you know, just because I was going to not play for the Vikings didn't mean I couldn't go and try out with another team. But I just didn't feel like it. I just felt, hey, maybe this is fitting. Although I was disappointed that, you know, my career was ending, you know, I felt like, you know, this may open up greater opportunities in some respects, a path that I had already forged through education and the fact that the Vikings wanted me to come back as a scout. So it really kind of helped that transition to still be involved with the organization, but not as a player. So it helped out really good eventually.
I've heard many an athlete say something, and I never understood it when they'd say, you know, it just wasn't fun anymore.
Yeah.
And I did track announcing at NASCAR Elko Speedway.
Okay.
And I love auto racing. And one day I was there and the late models were running, which was my favorite division. And I wasn't saying anything. And I'm the announcer.
Oh, okay.
And I thought, you know what? This isn't fun anymore because of a relationship, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And so I told him, this is my last season. I'm not going to do that anymore because it wasn't fun anymore.
Yeah.
And it is work, believe it or not, to do that.
Oh, yeah.
So there are a lot of, I'm sure, athletes you know that just said, nah.
Oh, of course. I mean, I played 140 NFL games, and it got to be where, you know, it just wasn't attractive to go through 6 weeks of training camp, you know, and still be lowest on the totem pole. Because at that particular time when I retired, you had Chris Carter.
Oh, my favorite.
You had Anthony Carter. And you had Hassan Jones, who were the starters. Jake Reed had just been drafted. So, you know, my place was really just more as a punt returner. I was a third receiver for most of that, but I ended up being the fourth receiver and, you know, returned punts. And it was, returning punts isn't a joke now. I mean, it's not for everyone.
That's why they moved it up.
Yeah. But again, it was, I felt that I was worth something. I had some value. But being able to go through that, the season was really, really difficult. So I always tell people, you know, when they ask me if I miss it, I say the only days I miss are payday and game day, because those were the most exciting and appreciable days that you could have.
Did you feel on the bubble at training camp?
Every year. Every year I felt on the bottom.
That's an uneasy feeling.
Well, it kept me motivated. I tell you that much. It kept me motivated. But I think that, yeah, because there were a number of receivers that were drafted during my tenure, and some of them worked. Many of them did work. You know, I came in 81, and, you know, Ahmad Rashad and Sammy White were the receivers. Joe Sensor was the tight end. And you're talking about trying to crack that lineup. It wasn't easy. And, you know, certainly because of injuries, Ahmad and Sammy retired, and Joe had an injury as well. So some of the new guys, such as myself, Anthony Carter, you know, Steve Jordan, you know, Darren Nelson, we all kind of came in at the beginning of the 80s and played substantially throughout the 80s. And then toward the end, you know, you had Jake Reed and Hassan Jones and Chris Carter, come in and start their careers there with the Vikings. So the evolution of that is such that it's inevitable. It's going to be something that, you know, you really have to plan for. And if you don't nowadays, shame on you. Because the athletes are in definitely making enough money to retire on, let alone live on after their careers. And what we find is that a lot of the careers are much shorter than they used to be.
Yeah, I was surprised. I thought it was like a five or now it's like two.
Well, the average for a draft choice is 4 years.
Four.
So, okay. And there's been many number one draft choices, as you well know. We've had it with Teddy Bridgewater with the Vikings. Many of them don't last. And that's one thing that I think is more evident in football than many of the other sports, is that the volatility of a career is very substantial.
As a professional, here's a grade school question, all right?
Okay.
What do you think is the toughest position on the field, both 11 and 11, with all together of the 22 out on the field?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I believe all of them are tough, but I think the quarterback has more responsibility and has to be a little bit more well-versed in what goes on offensively. Defensively, you know, the middle linebacker kind of calls the plays. But all of them are tough. All of them are tough positions that you really have to know well, have to know how to play well. Defensively, you're kind of more in reaction mode than in action mode. You know, I think since the offense knows what they're doing most of the time ahead of the snap of the ball, it's much more difficult to execute. As a defensive player, you're just reacting. So, you know, you just go where your assignment leads you. And if you're able to do that job, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to make the tackle or even be in the play. So you can execute your job, but not be nowhere near the ball. But as an offensive player, there's a calculated process in which if it executes well, you know, you've done it pre-planned, let's put it that way. So it's much more difficult to play offense.
I agree with that because the defense has to go 100% physical effort, lineman,
yeah.
As opposed to the guards. And I heard one time that a coach said, if you have your hands on your hip, you're tired. Don't give it away.
Yeah.
Is that any truth to that?
Well, maybe so, but it does indicate that you may be winded. There's no doubt about that. But these guys are in such good shape nowadays. You know, I kind of wonder sometimes how you can get a hamstring injury mid-season. But, you know, I think sometimes, certain bodies are not, you know, made to do certain things continuously for a long period of time without something malfunctioning. But, you know, nowadays if you're injured, you're almost always on the sideline.
In a tent.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Hey, what you selling?
Fun.
It looks like a lot of fun.
You know it.
Can I give it a test drive?
Absolutely. Just be careful. It has a lot of power.
Whether you're in the market for a new dirt bike, jet ski, four-wheeler, motorcycle, side-by-side, or pretty much any other fun thing you're looking for, remember Leo's South in Lakeville. We sell fun.
Portable one, the one you want at Leo's South.
We sell fun. Visit leosouth.com to tempt yourself.
Residential or commercial, Cannon Valley Water in Dundas is the place to call for water. Whether it's a complete water conditioning system or just salt delivery and filters, Cannon Valley Water can take care of it. And Cannon Valley Water can also deliver Candy Yohai premium water right to your house or business at great rates, too. Chippewa Springs is as pure today as it was when we first tested it over a century ago, and is proudly distributed by Cannon Valley Water. Pickups are now located at 609 Stafford Lane in Dundas, just behind Aldi. Call Cannon Valley for your water today.
Hi, I'm Kathy Olson. Navigating the unfamiliar land of senior care can be daunting. We're here for you. Millstrom Commons offers the care and services you need and the independence you want. Renting one of our assisted living apartments provides you with 3 meals a day, served restaurant style in our dining room, weekly housekeeping, and the option of adding personal supportive services as you need them. Our staff's on duty 24/7 to provide that much needed peace of mind. If you're searching for options, give me a call. I'm here for you.
Another one?
Yeah.
You know this one?
No, I don't know any of those songs. Man, that's over 40 years ago. That's. What I recall the music. No doubt.
Okay, this is Kung Fu Fighting.
Yeah. Good singer, though. He sings it well.
Everybody was Kung Fu Fighting.
Carl Douglas.
So this is part of the top 10 in 1974, huh?
1974. You were junior in high school. Say, speaking about that, you had, your dad had 11 brothers and sisters,
yeah.
Or one of 11, whatever it was. And how many siblings did you have?
I had only two brothers.
Okay.
And I'm the oldest.
You're the
and,
oldest.
You know, interesting enough, the middle brother also played professionally in Canada in the USFL, if you can remember, the United States Football League.
Yeah.
And had a decent career there. So we both followed our father to Canada. We both, all three of us played in Canada, and then we ended up playing in other leagues as well.
That must have been a fun Thanksgiving, huh?
Yeah, for sure.
And when
for
you
sure.
got the time off. How about, you mentioned your daughters.
Yes.
How many daughters do you have?
I have two daughters, and both of them were a high school athlete. My youngest was a college athlete. She played lacrosse at the University of Minnesota in their club team, but, you know, had an opportunity to play across the country. In, you know, what I believe is a highly organized sport at that level. But both of them, did well in school. They're both physicians now. And you know, one lives in the Twin Cities, the other lives in Connecticut and is doing well at a hospital.
Anywhere near Hartford?
Yes. As a matter of fact, she works in Hartford, but lives in New Haven.
Well, guess what?
What?
There's a radio station, WTIC.
Okay.
In Hartford, Connecticut, that's 1080 on the AM dial, just like we are.
Oh, wow.
That's why I know that story.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's more to that story. But anyhow, you got to be a pretty proud dad, I mean, to have a pair of daughters.
They did well.
How far apart are they?
They're only about 3 years apart, but they did very well. And, you know, I think that part of it was because, you know, they, you know, I emulated, you know, those values. And at the same time, you know, they went to a good school. I mean, they went to a good high school. Eden Prairie was academically fabulous, and you know, gave them a good environment. You know, they were supported by, you know, their parents and friends. And I think one of the things that gives you is some good confidence that you can excel. And both of them could have been other. I mean, I think they could have chosen to be college athletes, but they decided to
be doctors.
You know, really worry about the academics a little bit more.
Speaking about Eden Prairie, of course, that was the area where many Viking former Vikings bought homes.
Mm-hmm.
And you still live in the same
home?
Yes,
I do.
Okay,
yes,
now
I do.
What neighbors do you have that were teammates or new?
You know what? In my first home, I was in one of my homes. Let's put it that way. Alfred Anderson and Rick Finney, who were running backs, were in my neighborhood. You know, and you know, we certainly had children who grew up together. And you know, but you're right. I think most of us bought homes in Eden Prairie. But at that particular time, Some of the cheaper teammates lived in Burnsville and Apple Valley because it was much cheaper to live there.
Yeah.
That was before the big bridges were built, you know, certainly 169 and 77 were built, and it was much easier to get across the river. And so they got a little smart there and started living closer to our facility, which was in Eden Prairie.
Have you ever heard of Rich Rollins?
No, I haven't.
Okay, he was I think third baseman for the Twins when they first came to town.
Okay.
And I remember hearing an interview on radio, and he said he had a place in Burnsville.
Okay.
And Burnsville probably had dirt roads at the time. That's how long it's been. I'm going to take a final break, and then we'll come back and do wrap it up.
Alrighty.
By the way, I would not be surprised if some Viking personnel, whether it's players, coaches, administrators, or whatever, will look at Northfield as a place to live, because Egan is just, you know, 45 minutes away, maybe 35 minutes away.
Right. Well, I know the city of Egan is pretty giddy about having the Vikings there.
Yeah.
And I think it's opened up new relationships. And certainly with the Wilfs bringing in their commercial real estate expertise, it's really fostered some business acumen that that everyone's appreciating.
Yeah. And you know what? I think they're doing a good job.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be right back for a wrap.
Graphic Man!
Hey, little shippers, what's up?
We came to see you in person.
Well, here I am, just working at Graphic Mailbox. What do you want to know?
Is it true that you make every sign?
Well, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but Graphic Mailbox has made many of the signs you see in Northfield.
How about for monster trucks?
Yes, we can put decals on almost anything.
How about on dinosaurs?
Well, we can make graphics of dinosaurs.
How about in space?
Kids, I gotta run. Gotta go install a sign. TTFN!
Wow! How does he do that?
The Rare Pair is a unique clothing store that provides comfortable shoes, clothing, and accessories for men and women. A store with high-quality brands and customer service. Now, through December 18th, The Rare Pair has 20% off boots, shoes, and slippers for men and women. In your favorite brands like Sorel, Keen, Dansko, Clarks, and Minnetonka Moccasin. Open until 8 through the holidays, The Rare Pair, located in the heart of downtown Northfield, has the lasting gifts of warmth and comfort.
Goodbye to you, my trusted friend.
Number two in all of 1974, Terry Jacks and Seasons in the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
When you were a junior in high school.
Well, the good thing about it, I recall listening to this.
Yeah. I didn't play the number one because, Barbara Streisand and The Way We Were.
Unbelievable.
I mean, she's a beautiful singer, but
the movie was great, but.
I remember when I was going to broadcast school, I had a hitchhike from the east side of St. Paul over to Lake Street.
Okay.
And this one guy would pick me up, you know, in the morning traffic, it's generally about the same cars at the same time. And this one guy was going all the way over there, and I had to get out there, make sure I was on time, and hopefully nobody else would pick me up.
Wow.
And he picked me up, and they played People. This would have been the song. People who love people.
Oh, right. Okay.
And this disc jockey, Carson Rennie on WLOL, would play that song about the same time every morning, and I just loved it. I thought that was so great. So I do like Barbara Streisand. Well, once again, folks, my guest this morning has been little Leo Lewis, or better yet, Dr. Leo Lewis III, and it's been a real pleasure. I knew we'd have a good time chit-chatting.
Oh, of course.
Is there any message that I didn't touch on that you want to,
Well, right now, you know, I'm doing some consultancy and running my foundation. You know, I'm still in the sport business. I like to work with families and student athletes on a personal level to get them to be successful. So I'm heavily into that as I always have been. But, you know, certainly I'm hoping to keep the relationship with University of Minnesota and teach one or more classes as we go on here. But, cause I love that the whole aspect of, how we embrace sport as a important social practice in our culture, and it's evident that there's not one easy answer as to why we do that, but So I'd like to foster, you know, more information about that, and I have some valuable experience in those areas. So I'm looking forward to working with you know, families in the area.
Well, I have one last question.
Okay.
Was it through your last visit here on the Wayne Eddy Affair,
yeah,
on KYMN 1080 AM and 95.1 FM that you met your partner?
Well, I don't even think I knew her then, but
okay,
all I can remember, Wayne, is that you and I went out to the Northfield Country Club.
Yeah.
And had a fabulous day on the course.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to coming back to renew that practice. And at the same time, I'm looking forward to coming back to Northfield as much as possible, because now I have a lot of reasons.
Yeah. Okay. Folks, I'll tell you if you ask me who it is. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Wayne.
Leo Lewis, my guest on the Wayne Eddy Affair. This is The One. We are 95.1 FM, and we are also KYMN Radio 1080.